Hello, Roger.
Oh, hello, Carl. It's Roger. How marvelous to speak to you finally.
Yes, it's wonderful. I don't think we've ever spoken before.
No, we've emailed and been in touch for many years.
That's
I
right.
think it's fair to say we've always admired each other's work, and it's just marvelous your review in the New York Sun of my Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Well, thank you very much.
No, very grateful to receive such a all that wisdom that you bring to your writing.
Well, thank you. Thanks very much. That's very flattering. I think that before we talk about the book at hand, about Taylor and Burton, tell the listeners a little bit about who you are and what you've been doing.
Well, I suppose all my adult life I've been fascinated in the theatrical personality, the music hall vaudeville temperament. So I wrote a book about Peter Sellers, who was an actor that had always fascinated me, a comic actor. Every movie he made, he turned himself into someone else with different accents, different walks, false noses, disguises. And after that, I did a book about Laurence Olivier, who again always transformed himself. Whatever he was doing, being somebody else. And this fascinated me, this way that people were playing games with identity, with temperament, with who they were, with disguise. And then I did a book about Anthony Burgess, who was a novelist, most famous for A Clockwork Orange. Who also was full of disguises and games and masquerade because his real name was John Wilson. He just came to England where he was a school teacher, but he turned himself into Anthony Burgess, a pen name, very much like a kind of actor version of an author, and turned himself into this bombastic literary creature. So then Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, well, where does the acting begin and end with them? Their private lives are just as crazy as what they were doing on the screen as Antony and Cleopatra, you know, as sort of these creatures they were impersonating. And I just loved that. I just loved the way they were larger than life.
Yes.
And so my mind all is always activated by monsters.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I think one of the reasons why we're what the right word is, more than just compatible, share similar interests. My biographies often deal with what you might call performing personalities, people
Yes, they do.
who do have different names. Marilyn Monroe was certainly not born with that name, for example. And Dane Andrews, though he was born with the name Andrews, was for until he became a movie star, was Carver Dana Andrews. Dana was his middle name. And they all went through some kind of transformations. But of course, some people are have more in terms of the acting personality than others. And with Taylor and Burton, as you say, where do you draw the line? Which, you know, makes it really interesting for a biographer. One of the things I noted in my review of your book about erotic vagrancy, interesting title too, you might want to say something about that, is that they were constantly inventing and reinventing themselves. I mean, Taylor
And
grew up
they
in
were
Hollywood.
permanent. Yes, they were permanently in the public eye. They were followed around by the paparazzi. They were on newspaper front pages. They took over magazines. Their pictures of Burton and Taylor all over the place. Their private life, so to call it, was as colorful and as exotic and as crazy as what they would yes, when they were given a script. And I rather loved that, I have to say. But Erotic Vagrancy, the title was it comes from when they were making Cleopatra, when they were making Cleopatra in Rome in around about 1962, Burton was married to his nice little Welsh wife, Sybil. Elizabeth Taylor was married to Eddie Fisher. And Burton and Taylor met one day and they started having an affair almost immediately. They were instantly attracted to each other, and they made no attempt whatsoever to keep this quiet. They went to, they really didn't. They were shameless, in and out of the nightclubs, in and out of limousines, taking them everywhere, all of press flash bulbs going off. And anyway, because this was Rome, the Pope, no less, rebuked them, accused them of their erotic vagrancy. So I thought it was such a
well, you can't
phrase.
Do better than that. Yeah.
No, I have Vatican seal of approval for my title. I think it might have been an Italian or Latin originally, but erotic vagrancy, and that's this idea that they were just sort of wandering around, following their own caprices, shamelessly falling in love with each other before the public gaze, and well, terrible behavior, and you know, because there were children involved, weren't there? There was going to be Sybil and Eddie Fisher, these abandoned spouses, and it was really incredibly irresponsible, but it made them world famous.
It also, you know, there have been lots of Hollywood romances and scandals and so on, but not in a kind of worldwide basis. That, in other words, Taylor and Burton, I'm not sure whether they're responding to something in the culture or they're actually creating something new that people get used to. Because, you know, they used to have morals clauses in Hollywood contracts and that sort of thing. And this couple just blew that all apart.
Yeah, they did. And it goes right back, I think, with Elizabeth Taylor to when she was a child star. And she was determined not to end up like being ordered around by the Warner Brothers or all the movie moguls, you know, those terrifying tyrants they had out there in Hollywood in those days, ordering everyone around, Louis B. Mayer and all these people, the cells next. And she said, no, nobody's going to tell me how to behave. It's nothing to do with them, my private life, except she didn't have a private life. But Elizabeth Taylor was a renowned and wonderful child star. Infancy. She made those wonderful films. We sometimes forget she was in the Lassie movies. She was in National Velvet. Yeah, she was in then National Velvet. So she was in all these movies about dogs and horses. And then she was in a batch of films where she was a daughter, and she's always having these relationships with father figures, like Spencer Tracy in The Father of the Bride, and there's another one with William Powell called Life with Father.
Well, the film I know too.
And they're really good.
The film,
movies,
the film that I know is Cynthia.
Cynthia.
And I know quite a bit about Cynthia because Sylvia Plath was absolutely entranced with that movie.
Yes, Sylvia Plath, about whom you've written very brilliantly. She actually has a little tiny mention in my book because in her diaries, I think it was, or took a letter home, she was sort of following what was going on with Elizabeth. I think she sort of saw a little bit of herself and Ted Hughes in that relationship. This sort of macho man that Ted Hughes was, and certainly Richard Burton was. But anyway, there we have Elizabeth Taylor as a child star. She'd always known fame and having her own way, very willful. Meantime, Richard Burton in Wales, growing up in obscurity and poverty, but nevertheless, he was from an adored family that had was this younger child, this very beautiful child. So he had everything his own way, really. And then he was adopted by this teacher. It was slightly creepy, I think, that relationship he had with this man who adopted him. And then at least it was a way of getting to Oxford University, and where he appeared in student drama to huge acclaim and applause. And he did it some time in the Air Force during the end of the war. On the West End stage, on Broadway, and he became quite a big star and a successful film actor in the 50s, well before Elizabeth Taylor came along. Richard Burton was already living as a tax exile in Switzerland. He made this thing, maybe some of our listeners will remember it, called My Cousin Rachel.
Oh, yeah.
Olivia de Havilland. He made a version of Alexander the Great, and he did. Is it the robe? Is it about the sort of biblical epics?
Yes.
It was very popular in the 50s. So he was already needing to live in Switzerland to protect his money and his wealth. So he was established before Elizabeth Taylor came into his life. He did Camelot on Broadway. Huge success in that. So when they did meet, you know, it was just like two atom bombs colliding. And it's meant to be about ancient Rome, isn't it? But really, it's Rome in the 60s.
Yeah,
I think they became the 60s celebrity couple. You had John Lennon and Yoko. You had Peter Sellers and Britt Eklund. You had Princess Margaret and Lord Snowden. You had Sylvia Plath and Ted Hughes. But Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, I think they are the iconic marriage. And the way it all went wrong is also very 60s.
Yeah.
You know, the overindulgence and over the cliff they went.
Yes, yeah. Now, there are lots of books about Taylor and Burton and Taylor herself. But you've written another one. How come? Yeah.
Well, the book commenced for me. The project commenced. I had pancreas trouble from what was called unmanaged diabetes, and anyway, down I went, and I was very ill. And after that, everything was very hallucinatory and very feverish. And I started during my recuperation. I was watching Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Taming of the Shrew and Boom, the Tennessee Williams film they made together. And these lurid, feverish movies really suited. And I felt a great affinity with them. And then I started reading the biographies, of which you rightly say there are very many, picture books and all kinds of books about the pair of them. But none of them really were describing the films. None of them were describing the work that they produced. Everything was rather sort of dismissive about their acting, as if, oh, they earned so much money, therefore the movies were bound to be rubbish. But I was rather loving them. And I thought, well, this is a window into the 60s, into their world, a world that's gone. Everyone's politically correct and woke, and they behave themselves, and everyone's very responsible and respectable. And Burton and Taylor weren't. And I thought, well, I rather like this. I'm never going to be, you know, able to emulate them in any shape or form, but I could vicariously enjoy private jets and steam and fur coats and things. All these things are never going to come my way in my life. I mean, I would like to have been Elizabeth Taylor for a day. I'd love to be Richard Burton for an afternoon, but I wouldn't like to be them for, you know, all the time. So that's how it began. I had this sort of instinct, really, that there was more to them than all these other books had ever, you know, sort of got to. They had go deep into this subject. It took me 13 years. And they became they almost became like imaginary beings for me. That like people in a novel.
Characters in a novel. Well, you don't write the book like a conventional biography. And one of the things I'll say about that, I didn't quite put it this way in my New York Sun review, but I think One of the things you accomplish in your book is to take the stuffiness out of biography.
Well, I never really understand why people are so, they find objectivity so important. That sort of neutral stance, you know.
Yeah.
That's just a rhetorical ploy, isn't it? The choices are nevertheless made about how you're going to present the material.
Yes.
And so I just put my own reactions, my own feelings in there. And people can agree or disagree, or it's like a sort of, somebody said once that my books are like someone on a stage doing this sort of recital and going through his pockets and pulling out coloured handkerchiefs and things, or falling through a trap door and you find surprising things. And I like that theatricality. I like the theatricality of my characters, and I like a theatrical way of writing, really. Rather than do this sort of dry chronological plot.
Well, you get into trouble, Roger, because especially with the Burgess biography, literary biography does have a kind of stodgy, or it can have anyway, a stodgy sort of nature. And when one reads the Burgess biography, yours anyway, which I just absolutely loved and also reviewed, but other readers said, oh my God, they were just aghast at what you did.
Well, I get a lot of hostility. I'm always surprised by people. Their basic reaction seems to be, this is not what we're used to, therefore this
yes.
This can't be right.
Right.
And you think, well, then I'm just trying to be original, but not original for the sake of it. I mean, this is how these books do come out. And I rewrite until I, you know, think I've done it as best I can. I try and do 1,000 words a day, never more than that. If I do, he loses focus. I have to read it. If I can't match that word length, I feel terrible. I think, oh, I've lost it. I can't do it anymore. I'm useless, you know. So it's every day facing the blank sheet. Always nerve-wracking. You never quite know whether it's going to work or not. But I love describing the films and the colours and the way Bill Taylor's in a film she made called Butterfield 8, for which she won an Oscar. But all these films, I don't think anyone's seen them for decades. But in that, her shade of lipstick and her shoes and the headboard, all the
yes.
And the luggage, you know, and I love that. There's a lavishness to Elizabeth Taylor that immensely energizing.
I didn't have space to do it in my review, but one of the things that really struck me and that you do so well in your biography is here is a woman really of enormous strength who was sick all the time.
Oh, she was. The paradox with Elizabeth Taylor was that disease and illness and hospitalizations sort of gave her all this paradoxical strength.
Yeah.
And she was always having back pain and she was in a wheelchair. But nevertheless, she was absolutely indomitable.
Yeah.
And whenever she'd sort of finished a movie, she'd be ill. But Burton was sort of a little bit skeptical about a lot of this because she was in a wheelchair. She was moaning and groaning about this film she was making with Warren Beatty called The Only Game in Town, I think it was called. And, oh, she was so ill, and could she get to the end of the shoot and everything else? Anyway, they did. They finally finished it. And off she went to Switzerland. Of the shoot, and you know, within 3 minutes, she was playing in the snow, chucking snowballs about. So, I remember hearing a story about Orson Welles. He was sort of doing, I think, King Lear in New York or something, and he was doing it on crutches and complaining about how he was feeling so wretched. And then, the minute the run was complete, he just chucked the crutches away and you know, ran off. Into his limousine. they use their bodily ailments as another way of controlling people, I think. Poor old Eddie Fisher, he was always like a kind of nursemaid.
And she'd
turn her the men in her life into these slaves, and then she'd hate them for having succumbed to her wiles. And I think that's why with Burton it was such a long-lasting relationship. I mean, they were divorced and then remarried and then divorced again, and then they did Private Lives on Broadway at the very end. I think she really admired his angry strength.
Yes.
A bit like she did with Mike Todd, that marriage that she had before Eddie Fisher that ended when Mike was killed in a plane crash.
It really struck me toward the end of her career. She does a little foxes. She's on stage. That takes an enormous amount of stamina.
Yeah, she went on stage at the end, you're right, and was very successful doing that role that most of us know from the movie with Bette Davis. And of course, Bette Davis really, really wanted the role of Martha in Virginia Woolf, which would have been sort of obvious casting in a way.
Yeah.
It was a surprise casting by Mike Nichols for that movie. But yes, she went on stage and she'd learned how to be a stage actress really from Burton, and he learned how to be a movie actor from her, because prior to Elizabeth Taylor in his life, he was a classical actor on the Old Vic stage and the National Theatre and the Royal Shakespeare Company. He was doing all these classic roles. She came along and turned him into a movie star. And then he turned her into a great actress, I think. I think people underestimate what a good actress Elizabeth Taylor was, because she was so beautiful and she was so glamorous.
Yes.
Private life takes over, doesn't it?
Yes.
In people's accounts of her. You forget how really wonderful and expressive she is on the screen.
One of the things that I liked about your biography, too, is that the conventional sort of view would be, say, oh, well, Richard Burton really dissipated himself. He could have, continued as Olivier did on the stage and so on. And he allowed Hollywood to corrupt him. And it's such a sad, tragic story. Not in your book.
No, I don't think. Well, it was a tragic story in that he was dead at 58, which is no age at all, is it? But the success of The Spy Who Came in from the Cold and Where Eagles Dare and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, of course, and Taming of the Shrew. I mean, did great things. These are achievements that will last forever if people go and find the DVDs and seek out this great career, this great work. He always wanted to be King Lear on the stage, and he always wanted to do Prospero and all these other roles that he never got round to doing. But he did all the Shakespearean history plays, all the Henry V and Hal in Henry IV and all that. He'd done great things. And even though he never played King Lear officially, he sort of played King Lear a lot in real life, I think, this sort of angry monarch, worried about his power ebbing and flowing, and the sort of valedictory heir to a lot of the things he did at the end of his life. A one Equus, where he's a sort of psychiatrist, I don't see failure. I refuse to see failure. And the people who accuse him of failure, I mean, what have they ever done in their lives?
Yes.
haven't come close.
He's an interesting Lear-like figure. You know, I think of this line from King Lear, when Lear is staying with one of his daughters, and he wants to bring in his retinue and all his people and so on. And Taylor and Burton traveled around with entourages and so on. And I think Taylor saw the analogies between these, and the line in Shakespeare that has always stayed with me when the daughter is saying, well, you know, maybe we could cut down the size of your retinue and so on. And he says, reason not the need. I think that's wonderful. I need them because I need them.
He needs them because he's the king. And he might have sort of abdicated, but he didn't really abdicate his heart. He still wishes to be in charge. It's quite interesting that Taylor and Burton sort of used to mix with monarchs and dictators and presidents of rather dodgy countries. They spent a lot of time with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, you know, the king that abdicated, that we had here in England. He was Edward VIII briefly. And they went to the Rothschilds and their chateau and all of these balls and enormous grand masked balls and dinners and things in Venetian palaces, you know.
Well, they were royalty.
Opera house. They were royalty, and they were accepted by, shall we say, minor royalty. People like Princess Grace of Monaco was another friend of theirs, where they'd go and stay with Rainier and Grace in Monte Carlo, and they were sort of Ruritanian royalty, weren't they, Taylor?
Yes.
No wonder the press was so fascinated, but it has blinded everyone. To the movies they made, to their achievements.
Yes.
And when you read Richard Burton's diary, which is one of the great actor books ever published, he was always taking his work very, very seriously. And what you realize is that no one sets out to make a flop. No one sets out to failure. Whenever he starts a film, if it's like that one, The Assassination of Trotsky, which regularly worst films ever made, even though, of course, I'm afraid to say I can find merit in it. I think it's pretty good. Joseph Lucy directed it. All Burton's diaries, taking it really seriously, this work, he's really doing his best. He was as bewildered as anyone when bad reviews came his way. And then for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, he was telling Mike Nichols, it's badly directed, it's badly written, it's going to be a complete flop. And then that was the biggest success they ever had.
Yeah, tremendous.
You know, people at the time don't know whether it's going to work or not.
That's for sure. So what should I have asked you that I didn't ask you? Is there something I should be hearing that I haven't heard?
Sorry, haven't heard about?
About your book and anything that I really didn't touch on that you'd like to talk about or that we missed.
I'd like to sort of get across to listeners and my enjoyment of the Burtons. I'm not disapproving. I'm not morally outraged by the coming on and off private jets wearing mink coats. You know, I don't mind any of that. To me, they're like some sort of Andy Warhol screen print. You know, it's pop art, isn't it?
Yes.
That 60s world that they and then Burton's sad decline and fall because of his alcoholism and chain smoking since childhood. It really did him no good at all, smoking and boozing. He made a film once and he told the director, I'm completely teetotal, I won't be drinking at all whilst we're shooting this film. I'll just be on one bottle of vodka a day. That was Richard Burton being on the water wagon. So that lifestyle, boozing and smoking, killed him. And Elizabeth Taylor, I don't think she recovered fully. She remained deeply in love with him, despite having several husbands more. But she did a great thing towards the end of her life, really. She became a great advocate for getting marriage. And when Rock Hudson died, she was the first person to come out publicly in support of AIDS victims and refused to have all the indignation. And she publicized the ailment and the disease and the people who were suffering from it, and raised a huge amount of money for their charities. And that was such an important thing to do. And Rock Hudson, she'd made giant.
Yes. Which
I would personally love to see. I'd love to see it on the big screen. I've only ever seen all these things on DVD. I'd love to see Giant on the big screen with James Dean, who didn't live to see it.
Yeah.
Big epic film.
I think one of the things that your biography does is, and this is a problem for biographers, if you just follow the chronological path, if your subject declines, the biography, in a sense, declines. You know, if there's a 10 or 20 year decline, that's kind of tough on the readers. But if you do the kind of circular or cyclical approach to things, and the way you work in the movies and come back to the movies and come back to the themes, and we go around on that.
And then we approach them.
Yes, technically, you solved that problem.
Well, I'm sure, Carl, you'd agree that the trouble with what we do as biographers, we have to do all the research, and then we have to write it all up. And I think a lot of biographers use up their energy in the research, and then the writing has this kind of they're a bit exhausted by this stage. The shape of every single biography pretty much is the same. You have ancestry, early days, school days, early struggles, then decline, fall, and then the book ends with the funeral service and obituary notes. It's the same shape, isn't it? And I thought, and this began back when I wrote a book called The Life and Death of Peter Sellers about 30 years ago now, which was made into a movie by HBO with Charlize Theron and Geoffrey Rush and John Lithgow, great cast, Stanley Tucci. And in The Life and Death of Peter Sellers, death was life as anything else. He was always involved with soothsayers and talking to the ghost of his dead mother and trying to contact people through spirit mediums. And then he had this fear of death, and he had this heart attack when he was very young. And so hospitals and medication and the knowledge that time was running out was part of his life. His fear of death was a big part of his life. So that made me realize there are maybe different ways of writing these stories up, you know. And there are plenty of conventional biographies of all these characters if someone wants a more straightforward approach. But that's when I first thought, well, I could do something with this. I can do something with this genre. And I was very fortunate at university. I had a great teacher there, a man called Richard Ellman, who wrote a great book on another great book on Oscar Wilde. And he was working on the Oscar Wilde when I knew him at Oxford, towards the end of his life and the beginning of mine, adult life, I mean. And he wrote beautifully. His books are works of literature. And I thought, now that's the standard to aim for, that biography should be literature. It shouldn't just be an adjunct to the sort of an academic career, so you're publishing so that you're not perishing.
Yeah.
I think a lot of biographers, you know, they publish and they perish. But the it has done me no good whatsoever. I mean, the people like yourself who can see what I'm up to, but a lot of people can't. My Anthony Burgess book, I think that's copies. The current rate of sale, I think the advance will be clear in about 3,000 years.
I know the feeling. Yes, I've had similar experiences.
Well, I think one year I had a royalty statement. It had sold two copies, and one of them, and one of those had been taken back to the shop. it's because the trouble with Anthony Burgess, people thought it was going to be about Blunt or Guy Burgess, the famous spy.
Yes.
So I was very disappointed, reader, but I have boxes and boxes of that book in my cellar. You know, this unloved book, but now and again, I do meet people that they love it and could see what I was up to.
It reminds me of the old joke about a person who comes up to the author and says, "I read the book," and the author says, "So you're the one."
Yes, that's right. That's exactly it. I know my readers by name. I actually did. I remember some neighbors of ours. I signed a copy and gave it to them. And then a couple of years later, I found it in a charity shop. They'd given it away. They said, they were moving house and they had to do a big clear out. And I thought, well, you know, at least if you're going to get rid of it, you could have done it further away, you know, some. Not just round the corner from my house. So it's just one humiliation after another, isn't it, being a writer?
Yeah, we should do a podcast about that. That sounds like it might be worth it.
Yeah, but my Peter Sellers book and Laurence Olivier, they were more conventional successes, shall we say. This erotic vagrancy, I mean, who knows what its fate will be. But I wrote the book I wanted to write, so.
Yeah, that's good.
And there it is.
Good or ill. Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Roger.
Well, it's been lovely to speak with you, Carl, and I truly admire all your books, and you've been an inspiration for me.
Well, thank you, and the same with you. I just find your books, you know, unusual in a really positive way. And as I said in the review, reading this book on Taylor and Burton, it's you almost put the reader in the room with you. It has a sense of immediacy that's very rare in biography.
That's hard to achieve, you know. If I write something and I fill the page and I don't think it's alive enough, I have to do it again.
Yeah. Well, we're going to do this again. You've got to write another book, and we'll do another podcast.
Yes, indeed. That would be great.
Thank you, Roger.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.